This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the most ambitious crossover event in pop culture history. This is a very special episode of two of Entertainment Weekly's podcasts, two of my personal favorite podcasts. This week, we will be talking about the two biggest fantasy shows on television right now. We are joined by the hosts of EW's West of Westeros podcast, talking about all things House of the Dragon, Lauren Morgan and Nick Romano. And then representing the Tolkien side of things, we have the two hosts of Entertainment Weekly's All Rings Considered about the Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power. I'm Devin Kogan, and I'm here with my co-host Christian Holub. Hello, guys. Are you ready for a very intense crossover episode?
Oh, yeah. You better believe
it. Bring it on.
Fantasy franchise smackdown.
Crisis on Infinite Podcasts right now.
I know. It's BoJack Horseman. What is this, a crossover episode? I'm really excited. This has been something we've been wanting to do for a really long time. It is, you know, these are two of the biggest shows in television history, both airing at the same time. They both have dragons and fantasy and swords and magic trees, a lot of magic trees in both of them. But I'm so excited to talk to you guys a little bit about this. We're not going to structure this as like a true debate because we don't really believe in pitting people against each other, but also we do a little bit. So we're going to argue a little bit and also talk a little bit about the things that we really like. But I guess to start, let's talk less about the merits of each individual show. And what have the last couple of weeks been like for you guys, just having two really great fantasy shows on television? It's kind of a wealth of riches right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've enjoyed both House of the Dragon and the Lord of the Rings of Power. Oh my God, every time the show comes on, I'm like, the Rings of Power, the Lord of the Rings. But I've been enjoying both of them for different reasons. I mean, I feel like they each have what the other is lacking. Like Lord of the Rings is so bright and you can actually see what's happening. House of the Dragon, not so much. The Lord of the Rings is about friendship. Like I cried a couple of times watching just the friendship dynamic.
People are generally just nicer people on the Rings of Power. There's not really good people on, like, you know, they killed one of the nicest people off on House of the Dragon, so
our sweet little boy
on our side of the on our side of it.
Yeah, and I wonder if you guys, how you guys feel about this, that since I've mostly been working on Rings of Power, you know, I'm watching an episode of Rings of Power, but it's not all for fun, you know. I'm taking all my notes to write my recaps for EW.com, prepping what I'm gonna say to Devin on our podcast. And House of the Dragon, even though I've come by West of Westeros a couple times, is so much more like a treat to me. Like, I'm just totally enjoying it, and I don't have to worry about taking as many notes. That's your guys' job. I wonder if Rings of Power feels the same for you guys, that that's kind of just a thing you can enjoy without also having to work on it as much as, you know, Nick, you're seeing those House of the Dragon episodes days in advance, figuring out who you're going to talk to, prepping all your stuff. So that's kind of the fun thing about having both of these shows on at the same time, is you get to really dig deep into one and maybe enjoy the other a little more casually.
Yeah, I'm friggin' exhausted. I don't know, Devin, how you're faring.
I'm so tired. I'm so tired.
But Lauren, I'll throw that to you.
Yeah, I mean, like there was a couple weeks ago where I was researching High Valyrian wedding rites. And it's just like, this is a little bit bonkers. And then I know, Devin, also since we co-host Dagobah Dispatch, like then I throw all the Star Wars stuff on top of it. And I'm trying to tackle the High Republic books for Star Wars. So it's just been like, Lord, like when I get to the Rings of Power and I'm like, I'm not really guessing who, like when people were talking about like who was Sauron, I was like, oh, really? That's who that was. I was like, I was just kind of watching it super casual. And like, you know, it's like I read the appendices probably somewhere around 2003. So, but I did not revisit them. So I've been much more casual with Rings of Power. Like, I'm like, I'm here for the ride and I'm not doing any research for this. So that's how it's been for me.
Yeah, it's also been, they're two very different shows, like just, you know, regardless of the different fantasy worlds that they're in. I've really liked the fact that even though Lord of the Rings is based on a literary world, it's still something we haven't seen before. So we really don't have too many references to be like, oh, this is coming, you know, the equivalent of knowing the Red Wedding and all of that.
We haven't watched Lord of the Rings in like this format. Like Lord of the Rings isn't something we're used to watching 1 hour per week at a time, whereas House of the Dragon fits very, it's on at the same time that Game of Thrones was. You know, HBO Max didn't exist when Game of Thrones went off the air, but there was another way to watch HBO on your TV. And so it's very much just kind of getting back into this regular rhythm of, my weekly check-in with Westeros every Sunday night.
It's literally got the same theme song. I mean,
yeah. Right.
Hopefully season two, they actually write a new theme song, because that's just been aggravating to me since they introduced it. I was like, write another theme song, damn it.
Like, oh my God. Another bop. Give me more orchestral, you know.
You got a custom Howard Shore intro. I was like, come on.
Yeah, I never got totally into the Rings of Power opening credits. I didn't really understand what it was. I mean, same with House of the Dragon.
I don't understand what it's about, but I was like, this is pretty. I like Howard Shore. I'm listening to this.
Guys, it's a representation of how the Valar sang the world into existence by, you know, the way the, you know, the vibrations. Yeah, no, I don't know.
Sounds good. It's fine. Totally.
I'm somebody who, you know, I skip both theme songs. Sorry. That makes me terrible.
Wow. All right.
It honestly took me till about like 3 weeks ago to understand what was going on in the House of the Dragon credits. I knew there was a lot of blood, but I didn't understand like, oh, this is like, these two houses are joining. And then these, like, I was like, there's a lot of blood. They have the same theme song. I'm skipping this. Like, that's, I was just
Liz, I mean, unfortunately, you'll kind of never, you'll just never really get a better fantasy TV opening than the original Game of Thrones one.
Yeah.
Because it replicates the experience of the giant map at the beginning of a fantasy novel that is so key to the fantasy reading experience. And so that's still the GOAT. As far as I'm concerned, the original Game of Thrones. So I understand why they wanted to call back to it, even though the result is kind of confusing.
Yeah. You can literally perform the Cardi B WAP dance to the Game of Thrones theme.
Nick, I think we're going to need to see a demonstration.
Never thought
at some
of it
point.
That way.
It happens every Sunday night in the House of Nick.
The House of Romano. Lord Nick of House Romano.
Well, you know, it's interesting. These, you know, one of the reasons I think we wanted to do this crossover episode is that these shows have come out at basically the same time. They both premiered in September and ran for about the same amount. The Rings of Power finale kind of came a week before the House of the Dragon finale. But even before these shows were airing, they've been pitted against each other since they were in development. That like, who's going to be the next fantasy TV behemoth? Who's going to fill the void of Game of Thrones? Is it going to be the direct successor to Game of Thrones? Or is it going to be the TVization of the biggest fantasy screen franchise of them all? And that's obviously been a part of online discourse with these shows coming out that is not something we started. You know, it's just everybody, kind of the question on everybody's minds. So with this episode, you know, we wanted to make it less of a competition or a contest or whatever and just kind of celebrate both shows and give our opinions on the shows we don't usually cover as much.
No, this is a competition. This is Elrond and Durin.
All right, that's my peacemaking.
Casa Doom.
That's, you know, I'm Elrond in Casa Doom right now.
We're going to collect our sessions, like all of our Lord of the Rings and our House of the Dragon sessions.
Yeah, I'm showing up like, it's all good. We're all friends. And Devin's like, no, we have to smash rocks right now.
No, but seriously, I am
Think
kidding.
To rocks, not smash rocks.
I am kidding. I'm somebody who, I think it's probably safe to say that the four of us are nerds. We're big fat what? Fantasy nerds. And I know this is, will come as a shock to all of you, but it really has been a joy to each week have, you know, the major water cooler shows and be about dragons and mithril and, you know, people getting eaten by crabs. Like it's kind of been a joy, like each week to what a wealth of riches to talk about fantasy television each week. And it's kind of fascinating just because of the overlaps are hilarious to me. Like I was going through like all of the things that I'm like, there actually is a lot of overlap. Like we've got, you know, two authors who both have the middle initials RR. We've got a lot of magic trees. We've got Valyrian steel. We've got mithril. I mean, like
we've got a sexy bad boy in both of them. Like,
damn right, we do.
I will say, I never thought I'd be attracted to Sauron, but yet here we are.
And I'm a little disturbed.
Yeah.
It's hot Sauron summer.
Whereas I do have to say, as an OG Doctor Who stan, I am delighted by all these people being like, wait, Matt Smith is really weird looking, but also really hot. And I'm like, yes, welcome to 2012 Tumblr.
Yeah, welcome to discussions about 10 years late on that one. Yeah. But, you know,
we also have two actors who are now both part of the Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings universe. Robert Arameo and what's the other one? Joseph Maul.
Joseph Maul, who was frozen Benjen Stark.
Right. And, oh, my God.
Now is back as the leader of these orcs. And then, like you said, Robert Arameo, who was baby Ned Stark on the OG Game of Thrones and is now an ethereal elvish princeling. So he's not a princeling. He's you know, he's a
I mean, but you know still. What the interesting thing is about, I got into Game of Thrones because of Sean Bean, because I was so into Lord of the Rings. And then when they, like, he was coming out in this Game of Thrones show, and I had somehow never heard of the books, which I thought was like, I was like, how did I somehow avoid this? And so it was like, it was really like him and my love of Lord of the Rings that kind of got me into Game of Thrones. So kind of was all cyclical for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody always talks about how George R. Martin has obviously constructed, you know, kind of reshaped modern fantasy. He's sort of the preeminent American fantasy writer. But I mean, he's talked many times and about how, and it's kind of hard to pick a fantasy project that isn't inspired by J.R.R. Tolkien's work. You know, it is, there's a lot of overlap, but there's also sort of a rebuke to a lot of Tolkien's work.
Well, Devin, it's like what we've said about how Tolkien and so much of Lord of the Rings is like one-upping Macbeth. And is like he's reading Macbeth as a young man and is like, this is so awesome, but I wish it was more like what I thought it would be instead of these wraparounds. So instead of like, oh, the loophole in this, you can't get killed by a man, is that he was born via C-section. Ha! Like, I'm going to do it as a woman can be the loophole in that. And a forest is going to come marching, but really it's just a bunch of guys covered in branches. I'm going to actually make a living forest that can walk and move and fight. Those are the ways that Lord of the Rings kind of is Tolkien's improvement on things he didn't, that weren't totally fulfilling for him in Macbeth. Martin has been very vocal about this, that he has some of that relationship to Tolkien and Lord of the Rings, specifically with Gandalf's resurrection, is that Gandalf dies in Fellowship, and Martin often says that Gandalf should have stayed dead because that's such a big moment. And then it gets kind of ruined by his resurrection. You know, the way the resurrection plays into Tolkien's Catholic faith and stuff, which was very important to him. But that's why Sean Bean and Ned Stark in Game of Thrones is killed and stays dead.
But yet Jon Snow came back, but
he hasn't written it yet. Hasn't written that yet. So
that
may be the big reason that he can't finish it. Because in order to finish the story, he has to break his own rules. That would be
pretty ballsy if he's just like, John, he's dead. He's not the prince that was promised.
That's what you think after you finish Winds of not Winds of Winter, Dance with Dragons.
If George just chose chaos and when he is writing Winds of Winter, whenever he finishes it, I just want him to choose chaos.
I mean, I respect it. I mean, I think more artists should just be like, what's the most chaotic story decision I could make right now?
Yeah. And so Bran's not going to be king, like, you know, Daenerys doesn't lose her mind.
Fingers crossed. I mean, we'll see. But yeah, it's kind of it's and what a gift it is to be, you know, have these sort of big high budget fantasy stories not just be, you know, set up sort of like a curiosity or a thing just for nerds, but to be like the major pop culture stories of you know, this whole time period. And also, they're just so much fun. And there's a lot of things I like about House of the Dragon that I think it improves on things in Game of Thrones. And there's a lot of things about, you know, Rings of Power that I'm like, oh, they did that really well. And I've been very impressed. You know, I was binging, you know, some of the last episodes of House of the Dragon yesterday. And I was just like, man, I love sword fights. I love stunts. I love all of this, you know, and that's something I've been really, you know, loved about Rings of Power is like, you know, all the practical makeup and, you know, orcs and fight scenes and all those things. And, you know, but I think we generally talk about House of the Dragon is a far more brutal world than Rings of Power. Rings of Power is generally more optimistic. But also I was like, there's actually a lot of pretty brutal stuff that happens in Rings of Power too. I mean, it's, I think there's some brutal violence and blood. It's nowhere near on the level of House of the Dragon. But I was like, there was a couple of moments in Rings of Power. I was like, ooh, Halbrand breaking that dude's bones, or, you know, Bronwyn getting arrows ripped out of her flesh, you know, in the big battle scene. I was like, ooh, there's a couple.
But I have to say, nothing compares to the birth scenes in House of the Dragon. Like, right. That last birth scene, I was like, I don't know. Blah.
Yeah.
So many traumatic birth scenes. I think that is one thing that one point in Rings of Power's favor is that it doesn't have any traumatic birth scenes.
Yeah, it's much less traumatic if you've given birth. I will say that. Much less traumatic.
So, you know, anybody who's out there who's listened to both podcasts, and I hope anybody who's only listened to one checks out the other after our collision here. But I appeared on West of Westeros a couple times.
Traitor.
But Devin, you never did.
Yeah, no,
so
Devin
hadn't. I'm kind of dying to know some more of your thoughts about House of the Dragon. You're kind of the one among us four who hasn't really weighed in on the other show. I mean, like, do you support the blacks or the greens? Like, give us some of your thoughts about what characters kind of stick out to you about.
Have you read Fire and Blood, Devin, or no?
No, I never read Fire and Blood. So this was all new to me. This whole, I mean, like, I knew the basic arcs, you know, of sort of the storyline, you know, and some of the major players just by osmosis, just by reading about, you know, things online and just being a fan on the internet. But this was pretty new to me. And I have to say, when the show started, I was very burned out on Game of Thrones. I was very exhausted by Game of Thrones discourse sort of after the finale. And I was just like, oh, really? We're going back to Westeros again. And I was pleasantly surprised to be proven wrong. I was surprised by how quickly I was, you know, brought back into this world. And I was like, oh yeah, this is everything I loved about Game of Thrones. Along with some of the things where I'm like, oh my God, can we stop with the, you know, the very gratuitous violent scenes. And oh my God, can we please stop having to make me adjust the brightness settings on my television? My number one pet peeve, Christian's heard me yell about it. This is the thing where I think Lord of the Rings has the absolute advantage of being able to actually see what the hell is going on. No, but I went from being very skeptical and being like, oh, this is an obligation. I guess I'll watch, you know, House of the Dragon, to being like, oh no, I'm actually looking forward to this each week. And like, I really do enjoy spending time with these characters. And I think for me, that comes down to the performances. I think they really take what is otherwise, you know, and I feel the same way about Rings of Power. You know, I think the performances from the actors really, really elevate it for me. When the time jump happens in what, episode 6, I was a little bit like, I was a little heartbroken because I become so attached to these young actors. And I was like, I can't imagine, you know, what the rest of this story will look like without them. And then immediately was won over. So I don't know. And I mean, look, I'm a Matt Smith stan. What can I say? I'm going to keep watching this show. Like, I love me some Matt Smith. So yeah, that's my sort of overall thoughts. I went from being, like many people, I'm sure, sort of like wary and sort of burned out on Game of Thrones, to being like, no, this is a world I like spending time in. And I look forward to it each week.
Yeah, so for me with the Rings of Power, I read The Lord of the Rings in high school, haven't read them since. I read The Hobbit also in high school, haven't read it since. Have not read The Silmarillion. So it's been wonderful to listen to your podcast to get all the juicy details on everything that I'm missing. I really enjoyed how this show embraced the serialized storytelling more so than I think House of the Dragon. Because, I mean, even the showrunners of House of the Dragon will be like, yeah, we have a lot of time jumps, so we kind of have to have a beginning and an end for each episode, and people can kind of, you know, jump in and out of them. But like, there were cliffhangers in the Rings of Power. There's a season long mystery about Sauron. And also you have stunt queens. Oh my God, we thought the Targaryens were the only stunt queens, but oh my, I love this shape changing, Sauron loving, bald, zealot person. I don't know the exact terminology, but I'm like, woo! It's like a drag race reveal. It's like, we love a reveal. And it also had a lot of the spectacle that I was kind of missing a little bit from House of the Dragon. We're getting it more now that we're in the finale with the first dragon battle and all of that. But I felt like almost every episode of The Rings of Power had some kind of fantastical spectacle that you could really enjoy. Also, love Galadriel. Oh my God, I think my favorite scene was just that one scene where she's a Numenor and all the other fighters are training and she's dancing about them. Like, it's Lord of the Rings, I felt, embraced just the pure joy of fantasy, whereas House of the Dragon's like, no, we're going to kill people and it's going to be terrible.
And there's going to be incest and everybody's rotten, you know.
I mean, that's kind of the general mission statement for each show is so different. I mean, Tolkien has always been about, you know, man, wouldn't it be lovely to live in this world and be a hobbit? And like, I mean, yeah, there would be a lot of terrible things that could also happen. But like, as a general rule, fantasy is escapism. Whereas George R. R. Martin is like, no, being in a fantasy story would be the worst thing possible. You could pay me. No, there's so many ways to die.
Yeah.
Even if you're like a decent person, doesn't matter. You're still going to die. But Nick, I'm glad you pointed out that excellent, excellent blonde representation on both of these shows. We've got Galadriel with her big, long, beautiful hair and all the Targaryens.
With their less beautiful hair, I will admit.
some of them with better hair than others, we'll say. Yeah. But yeah, no, we love the aesthetic.
So I'm going to say my favorite character, I think, is Galadriel. But my favorite actor is, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, the actress behind Disa, Sofia Nomvetti. She is just so excited to talk about this show every single chance she gets. And it's so infectious. I absolutely love it. Christian and Devin, what are your, do you have favorite power players on House of the Dragon versus like the actors who play them?
I mean, I just got to say, because his run kind of ended since the last time I was on West of Westeros, Paddy Considine totally blew me away this season as King Viserys. And I think there's stuff to talk about with both these shows. I think both these shows have a pretty interesting relationship to their source material. Even though Rings of Power isn't adapting something directly, it's playing with your knowledge of what's in the Silmarillion and what's, you know, the opening flashback of Lord of the Rings, The Last Alliance of Elves and Men, that it's playing with in unexpected ways. And Devin, you didn't read Fire and Blood at all. I, like Nick and Lauren, was a big fan of Fire and Blood, and I have been so pleasantly surprised throughout at how the show House of the Dragon has, I don't know if I would say improved, but taken a different approach to its story than Fire and Blood, and done some interesting things that brought stuff out of the story that aren't there in Fire and Blood. And Paddy Considine's performance as King Viserys for me is kind of the hallmark of that, because that is a character who is like almost unremarkable in the book and is like just kind of, you just kind of get by the numbers, like, oh, this was a king, he wanted to please everybody, which is a bad thing for a king to do, because then you're just gonna piss everybody off inevitably. And he died, and then the war broke out basically as soon as he died. And yet Paddy brought to this character so much. I mean, I just like fell in love with him, even though obviously I can see his flaws and how this conflict he's so desperate to stop is only going to happen anyway. Adding Aegon's prophecy, you know, this is another element of relationship to the source material that the characters know, that, you know, having the characters, or at least some of the characters, know that the ice zombie apocalypse is coming and still screw everything up and go through this horrible civil war that's going to wreck and destabilize the continent gives it such tragedy and pathos, I think. Rings of Power has its own versions of that in a couple different ways, especially with the Southlands and Mordor and Sauron and stuff. But his performance kind of just totally blew me away by his final episode. I mean, Nick and Lauren, you guys covered this, but like I'm moved to tears by just the sight of him walking across a room for 5 minutes.
Oh yeah, that totally got me when I saw the screener.
I really want him to be in Emmy contention next year. I just think it's incredible. And even Martin himself had posted a blog after the episode where he died, basically saying exactly what I'm saying. Like, I almost want to go back and rewrite the parts of Fire and Blood about Viserys because he brought stuff out of that character that was not on the page, that is not from me, that I thought was so interesting. And then, so that's my main thing about House of the Dragon. But then I also want to give a shout out to Olivia Cooke. You know, this was a, you know, Devin, as you're saying, such a big part of House of the Dragon's first season was these time jumps, which Rings of Power took a different, instead of doing time jumps, Rings of Power kind of just is compressing everything so that things that in Tolkien's indices or whatever happen over a long period of time are instead all happening at once. House of the Dragon obviously is instead doing the passage of time. And so, you know, we all loved those early actresses, Millie Alcock and Emily Carey, who introduced us to Rhaenyra and Alicent, had such a youthful power to them. And there was a big question kind of hanging over the season of, am I going to be able to follow these characters into their time jump and into the older actors? And Olivia Cooke's performance in particular as the grown-up Alicent really wowed me over a couple episodes and really helped me. Again, when it comes to source material, I really feel like she's helping me wrap my head around a character that in the book is kind of hard to totally understand. And even in the early episodes of the show was like, I don't quite know what this woman is thinking or where she's going or what she wants. And by the end of the season, I feel like I totally do. And so those are the two kind of performers I want to shout out from House of the Dragon. Although it's a great cast all around, and I think it's a great balance of like both old veteran actors like Patty Considine, like Reese Ifans, who know exactly what they're doing and can spice up a scene where they're just sitting around a table, and you have these young vivacious stars who are bringing kind of that nuclear charisma. It's a great balance, I think.
Yeah, Lauren wrote a great piece specifically for EW.com, specifically about Olivia Cooke's performance that I thought was a great read.
No, thank you. I just went up last night, so I don't think, oh no, I did tweet it out. I couldn't remember if I had, but I that's what I did think, like, because I hated Allison in the book. I was like, this, I won't say it. I was like, this woman, like, she's, you know, and I thought Olivia gave a lot of texture to a character that, you know, like in the book is just kind of like an ambitious schemer, like the stepmother from hell, like I said in my piece. And she made it like much more like this person who's been kind of ground down by the patriarchy that she's living under and doesn't realize it and is just basically living to serve the whims of the men around her. And she's miserable and doesn't seem to even realize it. And she can't even, like, you know, that great line that Renée said about, you know, making a window into her prison. And that was sort of, you know, I just thought that, like, Olivia Cooke brought so much texture to that as well. But, like, Devin, I know you're a Matt Smith fangirl, but was there anybody else on House of the Dragon?
I mean, we love my boy Matt Smith. I also, you know, was really, really impressed by Millie Alcock as the young Rhaenyra. I just, like, every time she was on screen, I was like, she was an actor I was totally unfamiliar with, as I think, you know, probably a lot of people were. And I was just, like, very, very impressed by how she carried those, specifically the first, you know, 5 episodes.
Yeah, I thought she was great too. And I mean, she had like the showier role than Emily Carey did. And it was funny because like Emily Carey at first, I wasn't really quite sure about her. But then as I was rewatching the episodes during the season, I thought she was really showing like how much Alicent was just trying to serve the whims of her father, but just wasn't, like, you know, like nothing that she was doing was for her own happiness. It was just doing because of her duty, and how like later on that devotion to her duty kind of just turned her into this bitter wreck, you know, that she had been doing everything that she had said, and she just kept getting more and more bitter that Rhaenyra wasn't doing what she was supposed to be doing. And Rhaenyra like deigned to like actually, you know, have a sexual relationship she was enjoying and all of this other stuff. So I thought that was pretty fascinating. There's one aspect about House of the Dragon in terms of the text to Fire and Blood that I thought there was like a very interesting conversation they were having about how history is written and how the history really is, because House of the Dragon is supposed to be the real events that actually happen, whereas Fire and Blood is like the interpretation of these events. And so like I thought that was like a very interesting conversation that the show was having with the book about like, you know, how this really was, but how it got kind of recorded in history. So I thought that was a pretty interesting thing.
Yeah, I saw someone point out Fire and Blood heads know that throughout the, it's written by a fictional historian character who was not alive at the time and is writing up, you know, the Wikipedia page basically is like what you're reading. And there are three main accounts that he's kind of choosing between at any time. And you as the reader are basically able to choose your own adventure and which one do you believe more. And Fire and Blood heads know that one of those accounts, certainly the most salacious one, is supposedly written by a court jester named Mushroom, who is not a character on the show, has not appeared. And so that creates this fascinating thing where, like, when you're reading Fire and Blood, Mushroom's account seems like, oh, well, you know, I know how it is. Like, even if that's the spiciest one, it's the jester, you know, those kinds of people, they know the real deets. And, you know, I'm reading the real dirt here. And now, you know, if you're kind of treating them in conversation, it's like, well, that guy wasn't even there. He made it all up. Like,
that's why, like, I joked on our podcast that I think Mushroom was really either Larissa's account or Otto's account of the whole thing. Yeah. Like, I just think that this was like, God, this was the anonymous account of what Rhaenyra
was.
That'd
be really funny to imagine it being Otto.
Yeah.
Otto is getting a book deal while all of this is happening.
Laris is logging out of his Laris account, logging into his Mushroom account.
XOXO, it's me, Gossip Mushroom. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, you can hear more of our thoughts on House of the Dragon and the Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to this special crossover episode of West of Westeros and All Rings Considered, where we are talking about the House of the Dragon and the Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power.
I was a big fan of Clubfoot on West of Westeros. That was before his weird little foot fetish thing, which not king shaming, but that character has been, you know, he was very interesting in Fire and Blood. Why I'm so fascinated by him since Fire and Blood is because you're not given any POV or explanation of why he is the way he is or why he's doing the things he's doing. And House of the Dragon has filled in some of those blanks with that character very interestingly. And some of it, as Nick has reported, has come from, you know, the prevalence of female writers and artists and directors on that series and female writers kind of being like filling in that blank and being like, well, I know this character must have this kind of motivation or something. And I think that, you know, as we're talking about our favorite characters from both shows, a commonality that these programs have is definitely a focus on female characters and not even kind of the worn out trope of like a powerful female character or a badass female character, but just showing how female characters navigate these difficult fantasy worlds and how they are, like you said, how they are in House of the Dragon, really emphasizing the brutality of childbirth and forced childbirth and what a body horror show pregnancy was before the drugs and surgery techniques we have now. There's none of that in Rings of Power. Tolkien's world doesn't focus a lot on biology or reproduction as such. And yet, you know, you have the dwarf princess who is kind of pushing her husband, my favorite character, Prince Durin, to kind of take over this power structure. And if he does, she will kind of clearly be the power behind the throne. Like, he's just kind of a swaggering guy, but does whatever his wife tells him. And then you have Galadriel, of course, who is the most badass warrior we see on season one of Rings of Power. And yet you get the sense that a lot of that is almost like she's pushing herself in that direction because she is so often belittled or underestimated by the male authority figures like Gil-galad and Elrond around her. So kind of interesting. I wonder if you guys have any other thoughts about these shows, kind of differing takes on female characters, both of which I think come from a lack of female representation or an underplaying of female characters in the original stories. Lord of the Rings, the books have almost none other than Eowyn, queen. You know, the Peter Jackson movies like took a male character out to give Liv Tyler's Arwen more things to do. Game of Thrones had fascinating female characters, but there was a lot of conversation throughout that show's run about, are we focusing enough on these characters? Are we seeing from their viewpoint, or are they just kind of being tossed around? I think it's clear that both shows have taken it upon themselves, both behind the camera and in front of the camera, to give us more female perspectives on these medieval fantasy worlds.
Yeah, and in Rings of Power, I think that's something we see specifically with Queen Regent Muriel, you know, played by Cynthia Adai Robinson, you know, her relationship with her ailing father, the way she's sort of trying to keep this kingdom together felt very Game of Thrones. A lot of the Numenor stuff felt very kind of House of the Dragon, kind of Game of Thrones to me. Just that in that you have, you know, scheming political advisors and, you know, this seemingly idyllic, you know, kind of beautiful city that everybody and island that everybody wants to rule, but in reality ruling it kind of sucks, which feels very Game of Thrones to me. And sort of the factions where you see, you know, between the faithful, the people who support the elves and the old ways and the sort of new Numenoreans felt very team green and team black, you know, as far as those sort of seeing those divisions kind of arise and seeing people take sides on either one.
It is very interesting to kind of see how each of these shows kind of play with all of that. It's definitely been a topic of conversation for House of the Dragon, because even though we have people like Sarah Hess, who's a writer and executive producer behind the scenes, we have two female directors, Claire Kilner and Geeta Patel, but it's still at the end of the day headed by Ryan Condal and Miguel Sapochnik, at least for season one. And then in season two, moving forward, it's going to be Ryan Condal. So there's been a lot of discussion about the merits of some of these scenes, especially like the childbirthing sequences we've mentioned earlier. And I think the interesting thing, for better or worse, is like everybody seems to have a different response. Like when you ask like Sarah Hess versus Ryan Condal versus Miguel Sapochnik versus Claire Kilner. I think a great example of this is Rhaenys Targaryen in episode 8, when she bursts out of the dragon pit during the coronation on the back of Maelys. We were trying to figure out, like, why the heck did she let them all live after they usurped the throne from Rhaenyra? I spoke to Eve Best. I spoke to Claire Kilner. Claire was very much of the mindset, like, oh, this isn't really her war to wage. If there's a war going on, she's not going to be the one to start it. Eve Best was like, well, I feel like she found, a mutual respect with Allison in that they are both women who are going about this patriarchal world and dealing with all of this bullshit. And then Ryan Condal was just like, well, she identified with Allison as a mother and it's a heroic moment for her. And I'm just like, why can't? And then we get to the episode and Rhaenys is like, yeah, this isn't my war to fight. This is your war. I'm not going to be able to start it. And it's like, why can't we just say that? It's in the script. I don't know. It just felt like there were so many, kind of too many cooks in the kitchen almost. But I also, even if it wasn't too many cooks in the kitchen, because I still liked that scene. I thought it was really cool, even if I'm like, I don't really understand the point of it, especially because it's not in the book. And I feel like that's a big thing that the historians would want to put into the account of Westeros. But it really just kind of highlighted that, I don't know, like the male heads of this show have a very different perspective than the women who are actually writing some of these sequences and directing them.
But the one thing that I have welcomed about House of the Dragon is there was so much unnecessary TNA in Game of Thrones, and like things where you're just like, oh God, it's like, this is so male gazy
yes.
right now. And so when there were actual sex scenes in this, and I think Claire Kilmer did one of them, I think she did episode 4 where you see Rhaenyra having, you know, her incest fest with her uncle in the Street of Silk, but also the her having sex with Kristen Cole and then Alicent having unpleasant time with Viserys in bed. But it was very much like that. I felt like that was filmed much more from a female perspective.
100%.
And I really welcomed that because it wasn't titillation for titillation's sake. It was really about like what these characters were going through at the time. And so, and I don't know how much of Sarah Hess has been having an influence on this stuff, but I have really been glad that they have cut back on that. Just like, you know, just can't I, like sex. I remember in Game of Thrones,
sex position,
where it was just like, for some reason we would be in the brothel with Littlefinger and he'd be, you know, like they'd be opining about something, but then like two, you know, people were going at it at the same time. And you're just like, I've been so glad that they've cut the sex position out on this, because that's annoyed me so much in Game of Thrones.
Yeah. It almost feels like that came from a belief that mostly men are going to be watching this show, and B, in order to keep them engaged, we have to give them a steady supply of TNA.
Well, it was sort of like a very much like HBO stuff was always kind of like that. Like, you know, the Sopranos had a lot of nudity where you didn't necessarily need it. And like a lot of HBO shows have always just had that kind of, this was kind of like a very like early, you know, late 90s, early 2000 kind of HBO thing. And I'm glad they really cut back on it this time. Like I've appreciated that as just a female viewer.
Yeah. And I'm just one, you know, I mean, that's a great point about HBO. I also just feel like there has been this stereotype for a long time that fantasy swords stuff is like a boy genre and is like a boy thing, and they're the, and so put in a male gazy sex because there's going to be males watching them. And obviously, as our two EW podcasts make clear, that's not the case at all, and women are just as interested in these stories as men are. So why not bring that forward into the writers and directors working on it and the characters themselves kind of navigating this world? Rings of Power is similar to House of the Dragon, then it's headed by two men and is based on this writings by a dead man. And so, you know, since Nick made note of that, I just wanted to say that it's true of Rings of Power too, but they've brought in a lot of interesting female performers and writers to kind of bring those characters to life in an interesting way where they can. Devin, were there any to what Nick was saying? Because I agree that the Rainy scene almost didn't make sense until I could hear from Eve Best about it. What of all the Rings of Power interviews you did this season do you think best explained stuff that was happening in the show that was maybe a little ambiguous?
Well, I think for me, I don't know if it was ambiguous on screen, but I think something that really won me over is, you know, the speaking to Charlie Vickers about the Sauron reveal. And you can listen to that interview on one of our episodes where, you know, I think that's it's a big swing. It's kind of it's an interesting reveal. I think for me, I was a little, you know, I'm a little bit of a book purist. I'm like, well, what happened to Annatar, the Lord of the Gifts, who was supposed to manipulate Celebrimbor and show up as a beautiful elf? But hearing Charlie Vickers talk about it, and this is something the showrunners apparently, you know, they all had conversations together, you know, about this idea of, you know, it being rooted in Tolkien and the idea of, you know, the idea of a repentant Sauron in the Second Age is something that actually Tolkien did write about. And just hearing Charlie's, and the fact that he flat out said, I didn't even ask him, but he flat out said that, you know, the relationship between Sauron and Galadriel, he's like, he doesn't see it as romantic. I don't think there's romantic things there. He just sees her as a valuable ally. And he says, okay, if she won't rule with me, then I can do it myself. But I thought was like very interesting. And because I think you could read some of those interactions as romantic, and I didn't really love that, although I think they have great chemistry and I think they should 100% kiss just because they're very beautiful people, but from a story perspective,
we ship it.
Yeah,
you know, we love a ship, but from a story perspective, I thought that was really fascinating, and because that was one where I was very much like, I don't know about like this is an interesting reveal, but then like the more I've read about it, the more I've listened to Charlie Vickers talk about it, I'm like, wait, I actually really like this, and I'm actually really excited as to how this sets up the future of the show.
I almost thought there was going to be a dueling timeline situation. Like my first theory when we were still trying to figure out who Sauron was, I was like, oh, like Galadriel and all the Numenoreans, the army, they're going to get to the Southlands and see it all burned down. And then we're going to get the reveal that this battle with Arondir and Bronwyn has already happened. That was one of my biggest kind of fan theories watching this.
Yeah. And this isn't The Witcher where there's like 9,000 different timelines all happening at the same time. Although there are some great blonde wigs on all shows.
Yeah. But I was definitely like kicking myself with the Sauron reveal because I was like, oh, he's a new character, newly introduced to the show. The signs are all there. Oh my God.
I did in fact call it. Just going to pat myself on the back one more time.
That's like the interesting thing is like when I was kind of with Rings of Power, I would kind of keep catching up in like two episodes at a time. Like, you know, so it would be like, it was like, oh, well, so every time I was watching it, I was watching two episodes at a time. And the first like couple episodes, I wasn't even thinking about Sauron at all. Cause like I was just watching it by myself and I was like, just not listening to the dialogue about it. But I did enjoy that they did turn Halbrand into Sauron. Cause I thought that was made it like Sauron. You always just kind of just like, I'm not a book purist. I haven't read anything outside of like the Lord of the Rings and the appendices. So I'd never really thought of Sauron as an actual person.
As opposed to a giant flaming eyeball.
Yeah, he's just a giant flame. Like, I know he was at one point, like, you know, because I know Isildur battled him. So I know at one point he was a creature of some sort, but I never thought of him as having like an almost a human form. So I was just kind of like, but I thought Vickers did like in the final where the reveal I thought was really well done. Cause I think also that did reveal a sign of Vickers that, you know, he was kind of keeping shelved for a while. And then it was like when he was like, yeah, I'm so, you know, fooled you and that kind of stuff. And then I thought like, oh, well, I'm much more interested to see him in season two and where he takes that as this, you know, personification of evil.
What I'm excited about with Sauron is the fact that like, just because it's been also like so long since I've read the books, like what are Sauron's actual powers? The Rings of Power, what beyond invisibility and seeming like super strength does it actually do? I want to know.
Yeah, this is one of the things that's kind of amazing about the One Ring, perhaps the most famous magical artifact weapon of all time, is that its powers have always been very vaguely defined, and Sauron himself has mostly existed more almost as a metaphor or like a synecdoche for evil than like a living, breathing character who can talk to you. So I'm very interested, like throughout Lord of the Rings, even in the Peter Jackson movies that I was rewatching for the podcast recently, they talk about the ring as if it's a nuke or something, as if it has some power. And yet all you see it do is turn someone invisible. There's a disconnect there that I think the future seasons, now that the rings are being forged, has the opportunity to kind of fill in. But Devin, you know, why don't we go off that? Nick and Lauren talking about the future of Rings of Power. What do you want to see in House of the Dragon season two? Or what are you looking forward to from the future of that show?
Oh, I know what Lauren wants to say.
Dragons.
A good question. I want to see more memeable Matt Smith moments, which I feel like is not too much of a high ask. I don't know. I've been very, the journey of the show for the first season for me has been going from skepticism to being like all in. And so I just want more of the things that made me kind of fall in love with this show, these lovely little kind of character moments and like little conversations that, I mean, like, yeah, I love a big battle. I love a dragon, you know, crisping everybody. And, you know, like, I love all those kind of stuff. But like, just some of the little, I don't know. I really am enjoying the tone of the show. And I'm excited to see it kind of continue with season two.
Do you want any Millie Alcock flashbacks?
I mean, yeah, I love Millie Alcock. I mean, I'm into it.
Maybe they'll play around more with the time frame.
Yeah, I'm curious they'll do with the time frame, because correct me if I'm wrong, I think they've said that they're sort of done with like the big time. There's not going to be any more. It's not the crown. They're not going to be recasting everybody.
We are now kind of in real time.
Except there's a couple of characters towards the end of the Dance of the Dragon that need to be a lot older than they actually are. So I was joking that I was like, that we're going to get like soap opera, you know, in one episode, like all of a sudden this, you know, 2 or 3 year old all of a sudden becomes 10, you know, and we're just not even going to comment on it. It's just like, they're going to show up later on and they're going to be a lot older.
We can do some Patty Considine makeup, like, you know, yeah, it'll be, you know, exactly.
Yeah, they've done it. Proof of concept.
Yeah. There's a couple of kids who need to be older than they currently are for the story to to make some kind of sense.
All I know for sure is that season two will have a lot more Negroni with Prosecco in it.
Ooh, stunning.
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 Ooh, stunning. Ooh, stunning. All right, folks. On that note, I think we got to wrap it up. I think so.
This has been so wonderful. Thank you for having us.
This has been such a joy. And for those of you at home, thank you so much for joining us. You can listen to both of our podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. That's West of Westeros with Lauren and Nick, and All Rings Considered with me and Christian. Come find us on social media and stay tuned to EW.com for lots and lots of coverage about both shows. Just because they're both on hiatus does not mean that the coverage will stop. We are going to, as you can see, there is a lot to talk about with both of these shows, and we're going to keep talking about it. So thank you all for joining us. And that's it for this episode of All Rings Considered. If you liked what you heard, follow, rate the podcast, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. To keep the conversation going, follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials, at EW on Twitter, and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag us at Devin Kogan and at CM Holub.
This episode of All Rings Considered is hosted by Devin Kogan and Christian Holub. Produced by Devin Kogan, Christian Holub, Chanel Johnson, Sami Junio, Lauren Klein, and Dalton Ross. Edited by Lauren Klein. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.